Welcome to Eucharist Podcast, where we're exploring what it looks like for a community of disciples to live all of life in reference to Christ. Welcome back to the Eucharist Podcast. I'm Father Joshua.
I'm Father Ryan.
And this week we're going to look at Chapter 7 of the Patient Ferment of the Early Church. But before we do, Ryan, how you doing, man?
Oh, man, I'm a little groggy this morning. We were up late last night. Joshua and I and Kyle and Elizabeth and Alicia, we were all at the Messiah last night at the San Francisco Symphony. It was our staff holiday kind of experience together. That was a really good time.
Yeah, it was really fun. We also got to have some really good deep dish pizza before.
Yeah, that
which
that
I know
didn't
Kyle,
hurt.
Father Kyle and I really enjoyed.
Yeah, Kyle was so enthusiastic. He ordered pizza before we all got there.
Oh, I know, yeah. But that's so that it would be there when we arrived. It was perfect.
It was a gracious attempt to invite us in. Yeah,
it was preemptive love. I love it.
The Messiah was really interesting too because it's like one of those few moments in San Francisco culture, like mainstream culture, when Christianity is featured like large, you know, like and there's that moment in the Messiah, which traditionally at the Hallelujah chorus people mm-hmm. stand, and it gives me chills actually when I think about everybody, 2,000 people in this huge theater standing up together in honor of the King of Kings and Lord of Lords. So it's kind of I'm kind of riding off a high of that.
It was pretty cool. It was funny because it kind of, the context of so many people in San Francisco being together, like for my wife, she couldn't really like realize that, oh, like this is the Messiah. This is a Christian work of art. So like when it started and she was looking at the lyrics, she's like, she leans over to me very quietly and goes, "Josh, is this a Christian thing?" And then I just pointed to like the title Messiah and all the Bible verses. She's like, "Oh," but she was just, it was like, she knew that going into it before when we talked about it, but just being in a room of like over 1,000 or more people here in San Francisco, listening to scripture wash over you in, you know, beauty that's been permeating for like 300 years, like 300 year old beauty, just washing over you was crazy.
Yeah, it's really cool. And shout out to Katie Lilly, who was in our church, who was in the symphony chorus singing. We got to hang out with her afterwards, and she was part of an incredible choral group that sang as part of it. So
that was pretty cool. And the coolest part, I think, about that was that we actually were able to see her up close and personal because somebody brought binoculars.
I got mocked.
Mocked
for this.
Father Kyle mocked you. I was actually like,
you used them.
I used them. I was actually, I mean, it was you and me with the binoculars, just checking it out, looking at
the creepy priests.
The creepy priests.
I don't know what to say about that. Anyway,
it was fun. So, okay, chapter seven.
Chapter seven. All right. So this chapter is entitled Worship, and it's an attempt to try to give an overview of how the early church understood and experienced worship in their context. He has a line at the beginning here. This is Dr. Alan Kreider, the author. He says, "The ongoing energizing center of Christian communal life was not catechesis," which we've talked about last week. He says, "but worship." So worship is, from the very beginning, right at the center of the church's life. And there's probably lots of implications to that. And we're going to kind of talk about a few of those. So Father Joshua, why don't you talk to us a little bit about what's happening here in the early part of this chapter? What is he doing?
Okay, well, early on, he also says, "Christians claim that week by week they encountered God in worship, from the heart, effectually, as well as from the head, mentally. And further, their worship was from the body." And so in this chapter, he basically goes through a lot of the general context and structure of many of the early Christians' worship. And so he talks about all the different, you know, the order of service and this, the different aspects of worship, how the Lord's Prayer was central, the reading, teaching, preaching, the passing of the peace, as well as kind of when they met and why, which I found very interesting. Was there any parts of that stand out to you?
He follows the historical story of how the church's worship worked. And of course, the church came out of Judaism, and synagogue worship was already a structure, was already there. So Christians built on that and utilized that for themselves. But they did some distinctive things. They met early on, it seems that they met in the evening. You can see that in 1 Corinthians 11, in other places where Paul's preaching in the evening, like that time where I think it's in Ephesus, where Eutychus falls asleep because he's preaching so long. So they met in the evening. They had a small evening feast together, sometimes called an agape feast early on. And then later on, there was an emphasis more towards the morning service that we might identify with worship. So sometimes these overlapped as well, too. And it seems like part of the story is about pragmatics, that when the community was small, when there was 15, 20 people or whatever, they could get together in someone's house, and often they met in domestic spaces. And they would have a meal together, then there would be sort of an interactive experience, maybe think like a community group or small group or something like that, but a little less horizontally focused and more vertically focused in worship. And you get some of this in 1 Corinthians 14 with the interactive nature of everybody can bring a prayer or a hymn or a word or something like that. But then as the group grew, it was obviously increasingly difficult to get that much interaction individually, you know, one by one sharing things. So it became the morning great feast, and some of the elements became a bit more tokenized and less sort of earthy and interactive in that sense. And this is neither better nor worse. It's just different, and it has to do with size dynamics. And I was telling Joshua earlier that it just seems like, this is very pragmatic. Being a church planter, I've experienced this. Like sometimes it doesn't make sense to try to do a real formal structure of worship when you only have 15 people present. And so there's, early on when I came to San Francisco and was planting a church, a non-denominational church, we met in the evenings for a Bible study on Sunday evening. And that was just pragmatic. It was because, well, people were available then. And that was when we had space available we could use. And so I think some of that's what's going on in the early church. But there's definitely a larger trajectory movement towards a more formal gathering happening eventually on Sunday morning.
Which is interesting, because he also kind of reminds us that Sunday morning was not a holiday for people.
Yeah.
And that's why they had to... You couldn't have like a mid-morning 10 o'clock service. You had to have...
It was like crack of dawn.
Crack of dawn.
Yeah.
Which is interesting. I know in our work overseas, there's many Christians who are persecuted in Southeast Asia. And one group that we were connected with, the Christians would actually hike out to the forest at like 3 a.m. in the morning.
Wow.
And clear off some branches and worship, and then sneak back into their homes before 5 a.m. or before people in the village woke up.
Yeah.
And that's just because that was the only time that they could actually get a group of them together, because it was illegal for people to group together in more than 3 or 4 people. And I've seen pictures and Polaroids of these believers, and it's like 20 people on banana leaves in the middle of the jungle worshiping. And it's beautiful. I mean,
yeah, that puts in context like the challenges we have sometimes, where I'm like, here we're in January or soon in the next few weeks here, we're going to begin offering catechesis at 9 o'clock. And I'm like, oh man, I don't know if people are going to come out at 9 o'clock on a Sunday morning. But when you hear stories of people getting up at 3 a.m. to go worship somewhere, you're like, oh yeah, well, if this is a priority, of course. But
yeah,
we're kind of, we're used to things being easy, I guess, in many cases.
Yeah, and it depends on what structures your day. Sometimes we allow our cultural liturgy to structure our time more than the church,
Yeah, and the church is like a leftover. It fits in where you can fit it in.
Because Sunday is the end of the week, not the beginning of the week, right?
For many people,
so you just bring God whatever's left. Yeah. You don't give him your first fruits.
Yeah. Yeah.
By the way, that was sarcasm, in case you guys can't pick that up.
So he also talks about how, whether it was the morning service or the evening, the smaller evening gathering, the worship services of early Christians were largely private experiences. They weren't trying to like appeal to the masses. He says specifically these weren't like seeker-sensitive services. There were in many cases outsiders present, but there was also a clear sense in which you had to be initiated into the body, as we talked about last time, into the body of Christ through baptism, and then be a person who was living according to the teaching of Christ to be participating in key elements of the service. And this is really interesting. This is very early. This is not like something later on. Justin Martyr, writing around, I think he died around the year 150, or maybe a little after that. He's writing about the year 150. He says that only those who live as Christ handed down to us take part in the food that we call the Eucharist. That's like a quote from Justin Martyr. So mm-hmm. There's like a fencing, as we sometimes say, of the table from the very beginning. And then interestingly, there's a kind of fencing of prayer, which I found fascinating in this chapter, that you couldn't just waltz into Christian prayer. A clear rule was that reconciliation was a precondition for prayer, at least in the North African church. Someone, the Bishop Cyprian, had that mm-hmm. as a rule. And so, and that also meant that prayer wasn't merely token. It wasn't, I think sometimes people think of going to church and they think they're going to go and they're going to sing some songs and hear a message. And maybe if they're at a sacramental church, they'll get the Eucharist and go home. The prayers are kind of like an afterthought. It's like, oh yeah, and mm-hmm. we pray. Whereas in the early church, prayers and the participation in prayer was a major aspect of what was happening in worship. It was coming together for the purpose of prayer. Mm-hmm. I think that's really interesting.
Yeah, I think that's, I mean, one of the things that he was talking about also is about how much their time of worship was empowering and how prayer was empowering for them. And I think he kind of makes a distinction. It's not so much empowering as in kind of the Oprah Winfrey self-help way where mm-hmm. it's empowering to the individual alone, but it's a sense of like solidarity this faith that that the prayers of the saints uphold and sustain the world in a way.
People got your back, know, like you're together in this, and like, you know, it's that band of brothers experience where you're like, hey, the world might not all be with us and other things are going on that are chaotic, but I know some people who are on the same wavelength and we're together.
And that's why they sometimes fenced the prayer time, because mm-hmm. like we were talking about earlier this week, like it can be sometimes very distracting, or it can really change that dynamic when you have some people joining you for prayer that aren't praying, or are kind of outsiders, or kind of in that liminal space.
Yeah, even one person coming into a group can radically shift the dynamics of a room mm-hmm. so that people aren't willing. Prayer is very vulnerable, and that vulnerability knob just gets turned down almost immediately. Sometimes when someone's there who clearly doesn't have faith, this is what I've noticed. Like, it's really hard to pray with people when you sense there's just not faith mm-hmm. in the room present. And I think of Jesus going to his hometown and he can't do certain miracles, which is crazy talk, right? I mean, Jesus, the Son of God, he says he can't do that because there wasn't faith present. And so if that's true for Jesus, certainly must be true for the church in terms of our prayers. So it makes me think that, practically speaking, when we come together for worship, that we ought to think about preparing ourselves to be present in a spirit of prayer. And we do this with like an all hands, all the volunteers who are part of the service on Sunday mornings get together early and we pray together. And sometimes I feel like it's like dead, like everyone's kind of, you know, scratching their eyes and waking up still and all that. And part of the reason why we do that is we want to prepare ourselves to be together as a group in solidarity and prayer for the world, for the rulers, nations, for the poor, for ourselves, for people suffering.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think that's important. Like, I love how in the prayer book, a lot of the prayers on Saturday night are prayers of preparation. Hmm. And like the evening prayer service is basically, this is when actually your worship starts.
Yeah.
I think also Alexander Schliemann in For the Life of the World, he kind of talks about how worship starts on the way to the church, or even sometimes the night before, as you're kind of gearing your thoughts, your emotions, your body towards coming before the Lord. I think is awesome. And I think he also, Kreider in this book, he also talks about the importance of body language. He talks about the Orens position.
What is the Orens position?
Orens is a position where you can basically,
when you see the priest up front.
Yeah, right? When you see the priest up front, or some people, this is actually practiced a lot in like charismatic churches.
Oh yeah.
Like the lifting up, like the stereotypical, I think in John Acorn's book, Things Christian Life, he called this like the half sail charismatic, where like your hands aren't completely up high, but they're also not now near your waist. You're kind of like kind of halfway up, and you're kind of lift, like, as if you're lifting something invisibly up into the air, which is kind of the symbolism of here I'm offering. So it's kind of like the positions of lifting something or
receiving.
Yeah. You're kind of your hands are open, offering and receiving, which I think really matters. I mean, I know there's a lot of neurological pathways and stuff about your kinesthetic learning in your body, but it just seems, I mean, it's like muscle memory for me. I don't know where I picked this up, but like during the Lord's Prayer, to put out my hands. And it's just amazing that, you know, even if I'm having problems focusing, as soon as I, you know, if I kneel or if I put my hands in the orans, something happens. Like there's this neurological pathway that just goes, oh yeah, I'm praying now. This is what I'm doing. And it's a real aid sometimes. I mean, it's kind of like a lot of manual acts, you know, making the sign of the cross, kneeling, bowing. There's something about it. Like there's some body language that means a lot personally and also,
This is one of those places where traditional sacramental Christians have a lot in overlap with charismatic Christians.
Yeah.
Charismatic worship is all about in full embodied expression, right? And, you know, sometimes traditional Christians have like thought that was foreign in some weird way. And that's strange, because actually worshiping with the whole body is exactly what we do in liturgy. And it goes back all the way into Judaism, where people would often, most often, stand for prayer. Mm-hmm. And the orans position comes out of Judaism as well, too.
Well, I mean, it goes back to what we said at the beginning about how worship was both effectual, like for your emotions. It was mental for your mind, but it also involved your body. And I think so often churches like to kind of camp, you know, set up camp in one of those places. So you have some churches that are just about emotions, or some churches that are just about stimulating your mind.
Yeah.
And then you have some churches that are just liturgical, or even some religions, you know, that are just basically, I don't know what's going on, but as long as I do this, I'm good.
Yeah, they're ritualistic.
And how it seemed that the Christian tradition sought to bring those together. So it was supposed to be, I mean, going back to our Jewish roots, worshiping God with all your mind, heart, and strength and soul, your whole being, mentally, cognitively, emotionally, physically, you're engaging God with all you are. You're living, relating your whole body in reference to Christ.
And, you know, I'll just be honest. For me, I'm bent towards the intellect. That's just the way God's made me. I love ideas. I love thinking. I love reading. I love learning. And part of the reason why it's really important that I enter into the fullness of liturgy is because exactly what you're saying, it counterbalances some of that. So oftentimes when I'm praying a noonday prayer, I'll be here at home. Nobody's really around. And I might even sing a part of it, or I might kneel down. I often kneel down during part of it just because I need my body to be included in this. So it isn't just a mind trip of some kind that I'm going on.
I actually have, I'm also that way. And I think it was very interesting for me in my spiritual journey, my Christian journey, going from, you know, sometimes in worship, like I just kind of bunker down and I just kind of would contemplate the lyrics and like think about all these, you know, theological concepts and very internalize my worship, you know, close my eyes and kind of, you know, tucker in. But then when I started to, you know, try out some of these things, try to kind of to bow or to use my hands in worship or something, I found it was amazing. It was kind of almost like breaking the seal. Mm-hmm. So I had this kind of furnace going on, and now I kind of crack the seal and it just kind of, whew, it kind of goes out and there's just like this flow and there's just, it was very freeing. Mm-hmm. And it didn't prevent me from having still very cognitive, you know, wow, this is really profound. But it just, it seemed to connect that part of me with something else. And mm-hmm. I felt a fuller expression of worship because I was engaging more of myself.
Yeah. We should point out also to people that the actual structure and form of worship that we do currently on Sunday mornings is not a recent creation. In fact, it goes right back to the earliest Christians. There's a guy named Gregory Dix, who is an Anglican Church of England theologian in the 20th century, and he did extensive research on what he called the shape of the liturgy. And he talks about how the early part of the service, the synaxis, as he calls it, comes basically, it's the synagogue worship. It's the reading of scriptures, mm-hmm. it's the prayers, et cetera. And then the second part of it, the Eucharist, was combine with the Synaxis to create what we have as our worship service. And so you can go back all the way to Justin Martyr or to Hippolytus or other people who are describing Christian worship and see essentially the same structure that we are following now all the way back then. And I think that's really interesting. And it goes out to all parts, like anywhere you look. You look in the more Asian direction of Christianity or in the African or in the European, it doesn't matter where you look. Essentially, there's a kind of standardized direction in which worship, how it flows.
Even without people being fully aware of it. Like, I think once I learned about the passing of peace, I had this, like, oh, moment. Like, this aha moment. I'm like, that's where the whole awkward greet your neighbor in the middle of the service comes from in some of the churches that I've been a part of growing up. You know, where you are like, you know, probably about a third of the way in the service. It's like, okay, everybody stop and greet your neighbor.
Right.
And it's like, I cringed at it. It was just so awkward. But that's because it was an echo of the tradition, but it was dislodged from its context and its kind of theological meaning. And so it was stripped of that and just basically, okay, I think everybody should be here by now. Why don't we stop, say hi, shake a hand, maybe go get a cup of coffee and come back. It was just so weird. But then when I finally was a place that was practicing the passing of the peace in the context of the whole liturgy and that theodrama, it was really profound. I think one of the first places where I was really cognizant of what was going on was in Malaysia, at an Anglican church in Malaysia. And Malaysia is a multicultural country, but they kind of have a social stratosphere of who ethnically, like who's kind of higher class and lower class and what jobs are done by certain people and not. And I found myself in a cathedral with people of all these different ethnicities and races. And at the passing of the peace, you saw people physically embrace as brothers and sisters that you never saw on the street. Mm-hmm. Like you would not see, you know, this type of camaraderie in the outward society. But here in the church, they're practicing something to hopefully take back into society. And it was just, I was like, that makes sense. And then also having it in some of the liturgies where this goes after the confession. Mm-hmm. So you've now been assured of your forgiveness, a reconciliation with God through Christ. So there's this vertical reconciliation. Now it's like, okay, now make sure you're horizontally reconciled. You know, forgive us our trespasses as we forgive one another. So let us leave our offering at the altar and go and be reconciled before we come to the feast. I think once I understood that, like the passing of the peace became so much more meaningful and actually something I looked forward to because it was this embodied practice of reconciliation and love.
Let's talk about the passing of the peace. The way he refers to it in the chapter here is the kiss of peace, which is where it began. And the kiss of peace is exactly what you're describing about, what you just described about Malaysia. It's an attempt to bring about a sense that we are one family. There's not class distinction that is relevant to Christian worship. And the kiss of peace was just that. It was a kiss, actually. And it was a kiss on the lips, which is interesting as well. There were some people who really liked that moment in the service, maybe a little bit too much at certain points. And so some of the bishops decided, well, we're going to make this only same gender. So you can only kiss same gender. Over time also, they also said too that you were limited to one kiss. Like, come on.
No coming back for seconds.
Yeah, no seconds in there, yeah.
No kiss for you.
Yeah. And, you know, you still see this in the European context for greetings where you kiss on the cheek and it's part of that. For us in the American context, kissing is maybe has a little different context for us. So we, in our setting at least, it's a handshake or a hug and a verbal expression of, hey, the peace of Christ be with you.
Yeah, I think a hug for us is what the kiss was for them, because it's nice to have a distinguishing kind of layers of familiarity, right? Like you wouldn't just go hug a stranger.
Yeah, it's a little weird.
You kind of maybe would wave. It's kind of like wave and then maybe handshake, then maybe like hug or maybe like the bro hug and then the hug.
Yeah.
Like there's kind of gradients to it in each culture.
Yeah.
You know?
So there's some irony in the fact that the kiss of peace is part of the worship service, because obviously, in the story of Jesus, a kiss was the very thing that betrayed Jesus. So, so that maybe this is almost like a redemption of that again and again, you know, in the worship service, is that this is now a tool of making peace and extending familial solidarity.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of ironic because it's almost, again, in the character of God to take something that was used for sin or for destruction or evil to bring it back and use it for good.
Yeah.
So something that was made to betray the Son of Man now is a way that we express our union to him.
Right. Let's talk for just a moment, Joshua, about what the implications of this are. Like, what does it mean that worship would be the ongoing energizing center of our life at Eucharist Church?
I think we've mentioned it a little bit before, but something that I really appreciate working with you and Father Kyle about is we're constantly, at least a core value seems to be not being afraid of ritual, but knowing that that's not the end all be all. And then also not being afraid of emotion, but knowing that that's not the end all be all. And it's kind of this seeking this sweet spot in the middle where you have meaningful ritual and purposeful and supported emotion and interaction, and also the cognitive side.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I remember before we came here, my family and I came here to San Francisco, we were talking about how you really would love for Eucharist to be known for their preaching, that we wouldn't just be about the liturgy, but that we would as he says in this book, like Origen quoted, that the sermon should be a time where people come and gaze upon Christ.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's very beautiful. And so that's one of the implications that I take back from this, or I take away from this chapter, is a continual need to kind of check in on those different areas to see if they're being neglected or overemphasized.
Mm-hmm.
And really trying to seek this vibrancy where worship is life-giving, and that you're not afraid of some of these things that might have been taken to the extreme.
Yeah.
In certain, maybe in some of our church pasts or different. Yeah. Things like
so
that.
So, like, basically, if I were to summarize, like, a holistic expression of worship is really important.
Yeah.
Yeah. I would add that, and this sounds really simple and pragmatic, but being at Sunday worship actually matters.
Mm-hmm.
It's not merely supplemental to, like, well, I feel like I need some worship this week or something like that. It's not fundamentally centered in you. It's that when we come together, we become who we are. And we need that every week. We need that almost like we talk about our breathing pattern of like breathing in and then exhaling. And if you don't breathe in, you don't inhale, then you have nothing to exhale. And so it feels like sometimes in our culture, even within Christian culture, Sunday being together on Sundays for worship is not prioritized quite that high. You know, people are tired. They're like, I'm just going to sleep this week because that's what I really need. And I understand that. Like, I mean, believe me, I come into Sundays exhausted sometimes too.
Mm-hmm.
But it seems like if we're taking the early church as inspiration, this was not optional. This mm-hmm. was like, if you're a Christian, you're at worship every single Sunday. And if you can't be there because you're in prison, you know, like you couldn't pay your bills and someone put you in a debt prison, or if for some reason you're a slave and your boss won't let you off, your master won't let you
or
go. Or you're sick.
You're bedridden.
Yeah. Then one of the most essential things that the early church established was the role of the deacons to take communion to those people, to tell them you're not apart from us. Even though you couldn't join with us physically,
mm-hmm.
we are in solidarity together as one community.
Yeah.
And I think that's such an important piece of what we need in a place like San Francisco is we need to yeah. have solidarity together and understand, hey, this is like when we come together and worship, it's identity renewal.
Mm-hmm.
We're being reoriented to Christ and to his kingdom. And
yeah,
that is way bigger than just, do I feel like I need a sermon, or do I need yeah. some music, or do I need the Eucharist as though I needed some sort of personal piety or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, now that I've kind of been in the more liturgical world for a while, I just now realize that, I mean, this chapter was entitled Worship.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe 10, 15 years ago, I would have been like, where's the stuff about music?
Yeah.
Like what type
drums,
of music?
Guitars, where are
yeah,
those?
Yeah. I mean, where does the early church fall on the whole drums debate?
Are they
stuff
conservative
like that?
Or liberal on that?
Yeah. I mean, how did they do blended worship well?
Right.
And it was like, no, like, and I think some of us not only approach that with the term worship and assigning worship only to music, where, I mean, there was there really anything he talked about with music in here?
He might have. I forget, actually.
I mean, it's probably
connected to the prayers aspect of things. Because you know, who is it that says when you sing,
you pray twice, right?
Yeah. Once with your voice, once with your
So it might have been in there between the lines, but a lot of it was like, this is, you know, we're kissing each other, we're we're eating, we're feasting, we're... And all of that was worship. And I think we need to, I mean, I need to continually to remind myself of that. And I think one of the problems with people seeing Sunday worship time as, or Sunday worship time, did I call it that? Sunday service, our time of worship, as optional, is this kind of consumer approach where Sunday morning is about self-help, or it's about, it's an individualistic thing where you come and you consume instead of being consumed or being assumed into a body. And I mean, I know that that is the liturgy of our culture, is for us to consume. And so if I can miss, you know, the sermon on Sunday, but go listen to another sermon somewhere else, or if I can just say, you know what, I just don't want to make the commute, I'm going to put on some worship music.
Bedside Baptist.
Yeah, I'm going to put
Church
on some...
Church of Our Holy Comforter.
let's be honest, confession time. Like, when I was in Bible College Seminary, when I found out that they aired the chapels on the radio in the morning, it was over. I was like, tune it in, listen to it, and then, like, during lunch, I'd make sure to be like, oh, what do you think of his second point with this? Just so people, like, if they, like, I didn't see you in chapel, like, oh, but he must have been there because he was able to quote part of this the sermon, or, oh, what about that song? But it was like, because for me, it was just, oh, we had to go to chapel as part of our life in the community. And I just thought, well, that's stupid. I can just listen to it. And then I forgot
this is like
how...
this is like a counterformation to the cultural liturgy of individual autonomy at some level, which is... all about us as consumers. And you're saying that worship itself, just by participating in it, is a counterformation.
Yeah, and to be honest, I don't remember a single thing from when I was just laying on bed or on my couch listening to bits of the chapel to check off that box. But there was many times where I was actually part of a community worshiping that God reached down, grabbed my heart, and changed my life. Or were changing the lives of other people, or things were going on, and there was just this communal, like... communitas, this kind of communal experience that defines definition, that was happening that I just was ignorant of.
Yeah. So, you know, as we think about forming Christians in a deep and substantial way, then we talk about a rule of life, which is another way of talking about like structuring your whole life and orienting it towards Christ. A major part of that would be that someone goes, hey, I'm going to actually structure my week around worship, not try to fit it in at the end. Well, thanks for joining us today for this discussion. We're going to do a couple more podcasts on this book. There's at least two or three more chapters, but we're going to do a summary of the rest of the book, because he moves more into a description of kind of how this played out historically. He talks about Constantine, he talks about Augustine. And so we're going to do kind of a one episode summary of that, and then we'll do one more with final implications of this book and what it really means to our church going forward.
Yeah. And then we're going to start another book study on an amazing book. Do you want to talk about that for a second?
We're going to keep it a secret.
We're going to keep it a secret?
Yeah.
All right. So stay tuned for good stuff coming at you from the Eucharist Church podcast here in San Francisco, California.